Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Sofa North, joined with my good friend, Brian Alexander. Brian, sir, nice to have you
hello,
on board.
Hello.
Welcome good on board, to Brian, everyone. To the ship. Come on. Yes, we're ready to take off again to talk about some exciting technology linked with science fiction. And mine, Brian, what I've noticed is, you know, we kind of put these notes up. There's a never-ending supply. It's like a fire hose of, you know, things happening and technology. Because with, you know, with me gardening, Brian, I think I mentioned this to you last week. It's, you know, I always wanted to do like a little news section in gardening, you know, before I do like a show. Oh, guess this has happened. This has happened. There's never any news. It's the same. You know, nothing really happens in gardening. It just chundles along, where technology and science fiction, it's just like a fire hose of information coming out constant. And there's a couple of websites that I've kind of, you know, I've got like an RSS reader where I can just download them. It's like every 20 minutes, there's a story getting popped out somewhere around the world, which is possibly could be used on our show. So lots of goodness.
Which RSS reader are you using now?
I'm using, let's have a look. I'll have to check my phone there. I think it is, it's just Reader. It's called Reader, R-E-E-D.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
Yeah. So I'm on with that. And it's got a few like websites, and there's enough to keep us going, right? It's just we could do a show every day. I don't want to put you, you know, put you on the spot, but I'm thinking
We really could. We really could. I mean, I have my AI newsletter goes out about once a week, and my backlog for that is just pages and pages of links and stories. That's just, you know, that's just one field of technology. Mm-hmm. You know, no, it's, the stuff is constantly happening. It's a fire hose.
Yes. Well, we're here to bring a little dribble of that every week into your ears.
That's us. That didn't sound right. Dribblers, that's us.
That didn't sound right at all. But anyways, we'll start off. And I found one, Brian, about AI and copyright. Now, I think this is especially for, you know, like science fiction, and we're all, you know, like writing, or we kind of enjoy writing. But hasn't there been an author who's actually used ChatGPT-4 and, you know, took it to the US Copyright Office and, you know, brought up a claim saying she wants to be this, you know, although she's used AI, she wants to be the copyright holder, you know? And I guess over in America, Brian, that was a kind of, and I'm guessing it is over here, like a big no-no. But this, this author's getting it. A certain amount of her work, her novel, you know, it's been approved by the US Copyright Agency, which is, I'm thinking, is a first, Brian, is it?
This is definitely a first. This is potentially a very, very big deal. The usual model of copyright in the US, and it's similar to Britain, from which, of course, we got the idea. And Britain is the country that invented copyright. That it's got to be this, you know, this organic production of your brain. You know, Tony C. Smith sits down and says, "I'm going to write this story," and he's going to produce it, or he's going to make this this movie, and it's going to be him. That's the model, and you can do it with other people, and you can share the copyright, but there's no room for technology, and quite a few authorities have turned down AI as an author or as a co-author. In this case, what's very interesting is that the Copyright Office seems to have accepted her as, it's an interesting creative role. It's something closer to a DJ, where she's recognized, what's the expression here, as the arranger? Selection, coordination, and arrangement of text generated by artificial intelligence. And here's the key part. This means no one can copy the book without permission, so copyright, but the actual sentences and paragraphs themselves are not copyrighted and could theoretically be rearranged and published as a different book. So that's a really, really interesting caveat. because I could just take one of those paragraphs and just run with it and say, okay, this is the Brian Tony story, and then go and see where it is. But this is a really important step. This opens the door, I think, for people to do a lot more with AI. For example, if I wanted to make a comic book, I'm a notoriously horrible artist. I cannot
it's legendary, Brian. It's legendary.
It is. It's also a family joke. My daughter is an excellent artist, and she just loves to give me attitude when I try and draw a line or something. You know, but if I can I can write, and if I can use a image creator to make a comic book, that would be awesome. And maybe I can do it now. You know, and I can just do half the work of creating, and then do the other half of the work of arranging it all. And there's this important bit in the story where the author, maybe put quotes around it if you want, says that it's not simply you just say, make me this page and there it is. You know, no Captain Picard saying, make it so. Instead, she's got to work on it. You know, she was saying about 14-hour days on making this whole thing, function. So it's a lot of back and forth.
It's funny because I've read the articles in Wired, and I've read the article, and you know, when I first just seen the title, I was, you know, totally like, this is AI, this is not really allowed. But when you read the article, it makes sense that yes, the would grant permission. You know, she's got, I think she's got a, you know, she's got a bit depression and bipolar, and she's suffering from, she's been in the, I think, in the forces, and a retired US Army veteran. And I think she's just, you know, she's used it to kind of, you know, talk about her kind of life and everything like that. But it really resonates that this is, she wouldn't have gotten the book done, and it's a legitimate reason to try and get this book out. And that's the only way she can do it. I think that's a legitimate reason to kind of use AI, and it's a great example of the goodness AI can. Yes, we all know that, you know what I mean, that the stories of people writing a book in 10 minutes, getting it uploaded onto Amazon and making, you know, a little fortune there before anyone realizes it's just been all AI generated. But at least this is, you know, it's coming from the side of the good side of what AI can do.
Yes. I mean, there are a lot of these, as you said, there are a lot of these scammers, and this is actually pretty worrisome, who are just using generative AI to pump things out, slap them on Amazon, and Amazon is not doing a good job of catching up, as far as I can tell. And so that's a problem. I mean, that's one of the fears of generative AI, is that it will in some ways pollute fields of content, or drive out, you know, crowd out good content. And that's something that we have to think about and take action on. But here, I think this is a really good example. Tony, I have to just confess, one of my dreams is to make a movie. And what I want to do is I want to make Stanley Kubrick's Napoleon movie. And I want to have the ideal cast, you know, with like Helen Mirren as Josephine. And so this is my long-term goal. As generative AI gets better and better at making more and more stuff, at some point I'll be able to, you know, give it a detailed prompt, and out will come the two-hour film.
I don't think you've got long to wait. I mean, you might have a little fight on your hands using Helen Mirren, you know, and all your famous actors and actresses, but I don't think it's long, you know, especially after what we've seen on, is it Sora, the kind of the, again, ChatGPT's, you know, OpenAI, it's them that keep pushing out. Did you ever see, I think it was Sora from OpenAI, Ryan, did you see where it was, the astronaut space one? It was only a little clip, but they had the red woolly hats on. And it was it was only about 10 seconds of image, but, you know, totally AI generated. But again, it just looked, you know, there was an astronaut on a, you know, a huge, like a real person with like a red woolly hat on, and the spaceship in the distance. And it just looked, there was a story there. If someone wrote that story, do you know what I mean? There was a cool story coming out of that. And just fascinating the way it's going. But it's nice to actually highlight something that, you know, this person, this veteran's needed some help. And what you've just said there, it's still a hard novel to write or a hard experience to get through because she's still, you know, she's working 14 hours a day on it. It's not, you know, that's a task in itself. So,
but it's better. She's this is this sense of augmenting humanity, mm-hmm. Where she's able to do something she couldn't have done otherwise.
But in the, I guess the stable door's open now to let a whole, you know, that's it. You know, it's gone down. I suppose this is the first step of things being passed for the goodness.
Well, at least in the US, in US yes. law. I mean, it's going to depend on what Britain does and what all kinds of countries decide to do. I mean, this may be a useful precedent for other nations to follow. But it's, you know, copyright is a matter of nations. There's some international agreement, but it's really up to nation states. And I could imagine China following suit with this because China has a pretty open approach to intellectual property. But I wonder about a country, you know, France could just say no, of course, because they're France, you know.
Because they're France, they just say no. You know what I mean? They'll say no first, then, you know what I mean, think about it. I was going to ask you, though, Brian, what...
Yeah.
I'm a failed writer when I was like 18-year-old. You know, I think I got one short story published. You're a published writer. Which side do you come down on? Do you know what I mean? Is this something... You agree with? Is it black and white?
Yeah. I love the idea of this author, what she's able to do, and I think for a lot of people, generative AI is going to be a boost to their creativity. You know, for people who have writer's block, for people who
I never thought of that, like a writer who has writer's block.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember Asimov joking that Robert Silverberg would have writer's block for like 30 seconds. but if you've got that, or, you know, you've got a great idea and you're stuck, you don't know where to begin, or if you don't have a good writer's group and you want to get feedback on your stuff, you know, getting that kind of feedback from generative AI can be useful. So on the one hand, I really do think it is this empowering technology. But at the same time, I do worry about, I mentioned before, the spamming of Amazon with, you know, all the awful stuff. And also, I mean, to the extent that digital texts are available, people can use them and take some of my stuff, you know, twist it up a little bit, put a title on it and sell it. And I mean, I'm concerned about that.
Mm-hmm. It'll be so easy to do, Brian. Do you know what I mean? Like you say, you just, mm-hmm. and I'm... It could be any writer. So I'm just saying, all you need is a transcript. Physically drop that into ChatGTP and say, write this a different way, but mean exactly the same thing. Bang, you're done. You know what I mean? So I could be an accomplished novelist yet then. There is still
you
time.
You could start. Get going. Yeah. Get going. But follow, follow her name is Shoup. Follow Shoup's path. You know, you've got some ideas, put them down, let ChatGPT help grow them for you. And what I'm waiting for is I'm waiting for an AI to be credited as co-author. It'll be Tony C. Smith and Eliza, mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever the combination is. Haven't seen it yet. And some scientific journals have actually rejected this outright. When authors have tried to put it in. But I think this will be a possibility.
I wonder then, the next step is just, you know, a book by an AI. You know what I mean? There is no author. There is just the, you know what I mean? And it's a popular AI writer. Do you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. it has a number mm-hmm. of books out, and it's just like, you know, the latest one from, you know what I mean? The Bicentennial Man, you know what I mean? That guy.
That's right. You
know, I've got the latest copy of the, you know. Wonder how long that'll be.
Well, it depends. I mean, I hear one of the criticisms of AI writing is that it's often very bland. Out of the box, it tends to be, because it's writing for a global audience. And so it's trying to be very inoffensive. It's you know, it's not very punchy. And I don't really criticize it for that, because I think, you know, this is why you can iterate the prompts and get it better. And also you can take the text and edit it yourself, right? But I do think the other thing is, people do like a lot of bland, awful writing. I mean, if you look at Instagram poetry, my God, it's you want your soul to die reading that stuff.
I haven't looked at that. I must admit.
No, but don't.
No. Do you reckon?
It's almost as bad as Vogon poetry, right?
Yeah. No, that almost like kills planets. You know?
Exactly. There's also a lot of nonfiction writing that people use. I mean, one of the uses of generative AI is to summarize stuff. So you feed it a 200-page PDF and say, "Give this to me in 10 pages with bullet points," and it can do that. And that's pretty handy. I can save a lot of time. One of my students did this really, really nifty thing. We were reading a very, very challenging essay, very theoretical, and he wasn't sure he was getting it. So he took a few paragraphs from it, pasted it into either Perplexity or ChatGPT, and said, he didn't say summarize it. He said, give me some examples of what the author's talking about. And it did. It gave some pretty good examples. But that's on the reading side. That's on the writing side, per se.
But it's like just what we're talking about there, Brian. It kind of hit home. You know what I mean? Where you just sometimes want an easy read. You know, you go on holiday, you're at the beach, you don't want a kind of a detailed depth book. You just want a bit of Jackie Collins, romantic fiction or whatever your spice is. You just want like a dead easy read. God, that's
so you'll appreciate this. When I was in college, I was working at a bookstore, and a friend of mine said, "Hey, I want some easy fantasy to read for vacation. Can you get me some?" And I said, sure. And I went there and I bought him a couple of these books. But I didn't know the books. I didn't know the author. I just went from, what looked plausible. And I didn't know this at all. But what I'd given him was Gene Wolfe's Book of the New Sun. He came back from vacation and said, "Brian, that's not what I meant. Oh, God."
I couldn't relax. I had to keep on reading, rereading the pages. See, AI would help with that then, because it wouldn't pick those books. It would pick, it would pick something that the early Tony C. Smith wrote in 1999 and never got published. Oh, that's fab. But it's AI on the good side. That thing that got me there, So I thought, I like that story and I like that conclusion. I mean, what happens in the future? I guess laws get upheld and then taken down, changed and that. So we'll keep an eye on it.
That's what happens. Mm-hmm. Copyright keeps changing every generation. There was this in the US in 1909, I think.
How can you remember this, bro? How can you remember that?
It's kind of part of my work. I have to give classes on copyright, which is a terrible thing. But I had to... there was one development where they were revising copyright, and they had to account for new technologies. So they accounted for photography, and they accounted for the gramophone, right? And that's good. But then right after that, they realized they hadn't accounted for movies. And so there was this interesting debate about what a movie is under copyright. And one side says, well, a movie is basically a stage play. So crowd is theater. People are saying watching people move. And someone said, no. A movie is photography. It's a series of photographs, one after the other. So it should fall under that. I mean, yeah, the law is pretty cranky and eccentric stuff.
They can certainly get you kind of wrapped in knots when you try and get your head around it. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. It's like reading a fantasy novel with a world that doesn't quite make sense.
Anyway, what else we got? Oh, we've got a great story here, which I've seen as well. Liftoff, NASA's next generation solar sail, boom technology launched. And I've known Brian a little bit, yes, this is coming, and there is kind of companies out there that are kind of trying the best, but NASA's got this up there. It's a little box that's just been launched with a solar sail, and straight away you do think of, well, the first, which was, Brian, when you kind of read this story, which is the first bit of book or film, TV that you kind of instantly thought of when you thought of these solar sails?
The first thing I thought of actually was three body problem, and that's because I had just finished watching the Netflix adaptation,
right.
and so they've got, it's actually not from three body problem, it's actually from the sequel book, and they have a solar sail, but they use it, they power with nuclear explosions, so you get a capsule attached to a sail and they hurl it off in a direction that goes past nuclear bombs, the bombs detonate just behind the thing and it rides it out. But then I thought about this, and then I thought, you know, really what I thought of was Moten God's Eye, which has an interstellar solar sail mission, and that's what kicks off that great, great story. Well, how about you? What did you think of?
It was one of the crafts in, and I think it was Deep Space Nine, the TV program, the Star Trek had a one in there. That's the one I think it was Deep Space Nine. I know I've got a list of certain ones that, so let's have a look. Where did I find? I had this list, and it was, let me just pull it. I hope Space Sales. Here we go. Actually, there was one by, you know, we talked about Michael Flynn. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Elfenheim, the book I read.
Elfenheim.
He had a one called, and I didn't know Brian Heath passed away just a couple of years ago, and I missed that as well. The Wreck of the River Stars, Rama 2, Arthur C. Clarke, and Gentry Lee. And then Star Trek Voyager, the Ninth Degree. Lost in Space, this was the 2018 version. And apparently, and I haven't read Solaris, Stanislaw Lem. There's like innovations, it says, in space technology, elements resembling solar sails there. So, it is a kind of trope that's being used, you know, like this kind of ultimate travel with like no cost, no fuel, just hurtling through space, you know, so. To think it's happening now, it's just apparently it's a little, I think that might be a picture of it there. That's like a little box. You know, it's not that big of a box until it gets up in space and then it unfolds this sail. Interesting stuff there. Exciting stuff.
This is great to see. This is a long time, you know, dream in science fiction and in science, you know, trying to imagine how this could really work, and I just love seeing this come to pass. You still got to get into orbit because you can't use this to get off of the Earth's surface, and it helps if you get some initial blast to get going. But I just love this idea, especially for getting out in the out and about in the inner solar system. It's just it's a wonderful idea. And of course, you know, it must for you, especially as a Brit, make you think of the sea and sailing, right?
I'm actually only about 400, 500 yards from the sea we live now as well. So, it's not that far away. We're on a bit of a hill, so hopefully it doesn't erode that quick. the approach and sea. But it says, after reaching the sun's synchronous orbit about 600 miles above the Earth, the spacecraft will begin to unroll its composite booms, which span the diagonals of polymer sail. After approximately 25 minutes, the solar sail will be fully deployed, measuring about 860 square feet, 80 square meters, 80 meters, the size of 6 parking spots. It's got the spacecraft mounted cameras will capture the sail's big moment. Now, I'm not sure, I haven't read the whole kind of thing. I'm not sure what its eventual aim goal is. Is it just to, you know, try this innovation of like power technology movement through space, you know, via sails? And
well, it must be.
Be nice to. Keep an eye on
this. This is classic NASA to try this out, see how it works, kick it around, measure it, and then build the next one. But it'd be amazing to use this as a way of getting, say, you know, Earth to Mars, Earth to the asteroid belt. I love this this line in the article. Oh, hang on, I just had it. 7 meters, the deployable booms can roll up into a shape that fits in your hand. Man, that's light and tight stuff.
Isn't it? Do you know what I mean? That's technology there. Do you know what I mean? Like, right there, that's even if that was just done today in a factory, it's still a process that you think, wow, that's remarkable. But it's you know, 100 kilometers in space, flying around space, you know, like by the power of the sun. Fantastic. Yeah. You know what I mean? Just beautiful. And like I say, the amount of fuel you need to get, you know, I've kind of heard all the reports of like get to, say, Mars. It's just astronomical.
As it were.
You know what I mean? So, yeah, you know what I mean? So if you can kind of, in the future, there's certainly, it's going to be, isn't it? Sales are going to be kind of one of the methods. If there's no rush to get there,
well, yeah,
that's... just set the sail and just let it go.
So imagine, you know, just offhand, I mean, thinking of if we set up a Martian colony, a base on Mars, and it'd be great just to have a sequence of these carrying supplies. Just, you know, every mm-hmm. 3 months, one of these arrives in a parking orbit around Mars. And I wonder just how far off this can get. I mean, you know, thinking about how the pressure, solar cold wind, unquote, would this, you know, be able to carry things out to Jupiter, to Saturn? You could imagine a whole fleet of solar sailors plying back and forth across the, or at least outward into the solar system.
Well, and you know, release them before the actual spaceship gets, you know, yeah. up on the air. The astronauts yeah. go there, you know, have that already, just yeah. that little traffic line.
That's a
going.
Great idea.
You know, so it's all, there's a few there before you even reach, and then
excellent.
Mm-hmm, and just keep on, like exactly what you said, just get them into space. Yeah, we'll use Artemis landing base on Moon because it's an easier spot, then just launch uh-huh. from there, bang, bang, another one
or
every
use
month.
The Gateway, you know, station, if they make that happen in lunar orbit. So tell me, we've just come up with a plot for your AI driven novel, right? Yeah, we're ready to
there
go.
There we go. Yes, we can have it finished by the end of this show, Brian. You know what I mean? You know, the next one, Brian, we're kind of putting a little show notes. And I'd never heard of this description, and you mentioned it last week. And I went away thinking, that's a great name, this Forever yes. Chemicals. And that has some connotation, you know what I mean? You think about... just forever, you know what I mean? Like the mess we put into the atmosphere, into the ground, into the soil now, you know. And there's a one on SciTech Daily. Almost 1 million people could suffer lifelong health consequences drinking water in U.S. prisons. I know it's always U.S. prison, you know, like U.S. It's these are the That's bad us. Boys of the environment there, you know. Dangerously high levels of forever chemicals. And I just seen that, you know, and I thought, oh, Brian mentioned forever chemicals, and it's I didn't even know that's the term for them, but what I, you know, a horrible thing to think about in prisons. And we, you know, you always see, like, you know, history on science fiction shows, you know, going back like 100,000 years, you know, like this species of alien got wiped out. Yeah. You know, there's always like this wiped out, forgotten alien race that was super, super important and super important to the kind of mm-hmm. the universe. Mm-hmm. Could have been forever chemicals on their side that knocked them out. You know what I mean?
It's part of the great filter. Right? This is, you know, does an intelligent species get wiped out by nuclear war, by plague? Now we can add to that forever chemicals. I want to put in a plug for an underappreciated movie about this. Called Dark Waters. It's a.
Yes, I have. It's. I don't even think it made much of an impact when it got. You know, it's a little. Oh, and who's the actor? He's the Hulk, isn't he?
Mark Ruffalo.
Ruffalo.
Yeah.
Brilliant little film that as well, and it. I watched that, Brian, and it did. It gave a great, like, overall feel and ambience to this kind of the place where this water had leaked or this kind of chemical, this place had it was just a wet, cold, you know, like a hard living anyways in America. And then for this chemical to get released from this factory, I think it was from a factory, into the kind of water supply. And actually it rings home, you know, because I used to work in the water industry, and that's the biggest thing was, you know, we had to kind of, you've got to make sure the kind of the water going out of a sewage works or out of a, like a water mm-hmm. treatment works where I work is, you know, first uh-huh. class. And funny enough, like, obviously now it's totally different because everything is monitored, Brian. You know, it's been a few years since I've been there now. You know what I mean? I'm hitting the good life. But it's all sorts of, you know, instruments and technology to make sure the water, whether it's sewage water or drinking water, into the river is yes. perfect. And obviously 20, 30 years ago, there's that infrastructure, that kind of technology uh-huh. is not there. And people's thoughts and ideas were totally different. It's just like, open a valve and let's just get rid of it. That was a, you know, a nice, or well, not a nice film, but a really one that kind of hit home.
A powerful film. I was constantly surprised by it. And it's a, if, mm-hmm. if, mm-hmm. if viewers and listeners haven't seen it, it's a, technically it's a legal thriller. It's about a, you know, the ultimate plot is about a lawsuit. But it moves in some very surprising directions. And it's very clear. It explains this really well. I mean, it looks like, you know, we've just coated the world right now with these forever chemicals, and they're just built in right now. The original story took place in West Virginia. That's where Teflon showed up in drinking water next to a DuPont plant, and a lot of these have been cut back. But they're forever chemicals. They're built into the world now. I mean, this sounds like something from, you know, environmental mm-hmm. science fiction, like John Brunner's The Sheep Look Up, right? I mean, it's very, very frightening. And it seems like we're stuck with this right now. You know, what we have to do is live with it, with all the casualties built in. So I suspect we'll have a lot of people trying to innovate ways of taking care of it, of getting rid of them. But right now, this is a struggle that's just beginning.
Mm-hmm. And like what got me was, you know, like a million people. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So you're in prison in the US. It's a factor that's happened to you now. You know, there's a lot of people in prison that's just, you know, there for a few weeks or something, but they've still got to kind of drink this water. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And bathe in this water that's
horrifying. Terrible, I mean, this is one of the mm-hmm. one of the great functions of science fiction has been to warn people about dangers, and
it hasn't worked.
in a sense, you know, we're aware of it now, but sometimes it doesn't work. I mean, fiction is a wonky kind of tool for this, but I think, you know, environmental science fiction, which might be coming back under the form of climate fiction, gives us some warnings and ways of thinking about it. That's a grim story.
We'll have to just wait and see. Story. God, it is. It was great idea. I've got
this
one
is a wild
from
story about brain implants. Yeah.
Yes. this is the stuff more like it. We keep, it's funny, Brian. We brought up, you know, like Brunner and all this kind of environmental issues. Was it last week or the week before? And it must be in like a, obviously it's an ongoing thing, but it might kind of just keep on hitting our show as well as we kind of discover things and technology discovers things. So, you know, like there is the likes of the Brunner's novel, and there was a number of novels, you know, like dystopian novels that are kind of hitting this mm-hmm. thing. So it's obviously a trend we're going to stumble into most weeks. But this one, you know what I mean? This one, I think, did you put this one down in the show notes? The next frontier for brain implants is artificial vision. It might have been me that kind of put this in, but I was just thinking, if again, for the better of mankind, mm-hmm. do you know what I mean? Me stepdad, Brian, had, I forget what the actual eye condition was, but, and it happened to his brother and his sister, and it happened when they were 8 years old, and I forget the actual terminology, I should remember it, but it became like almost blind, but you had like, you could see from the peripheral side of your vision. And it was, you know, it held them back through school and everything, you know what I mean? Because in them days, they didn't know what was wrong. They couldn't see the board. They couldn't, you know, really see paper and everything. And I also remember him, he's like, stepdad, trying to read, but turning on the side. You know, you'd have to read, like, looking sideways and that. So whatever, you know, to have brain implants to kind of help artificial vision, that would be, you know, if this is can pull it off, it would be fantastic. Now, apparently, I think this, am I right in thinking it's not like total vision. It's some sort of like, you imagine like a radar screen with like white blips, you know, so you know what, you know, if someone's lost the sight totally, you know, a radar screen, that kind of image processing is happening inside your brain.
Which is tremendous. I mean, part of the problem here is, you know, the brain is just this staggering complexity that we're still studying, still trying to figure out, you know, how it functions in so many ways. We keep learning about it and it's just phenomenally complex. And we have the chance here of being able to, it almost feels like a kludge, but a good one, to be able to, you know, give people some glimpse of the world. And right now this doesn't scale. There's this bit saying everyone's visual cortex is a little bit different. So researchers have had to experiment with the placement of implanted electrodes and how much electrical stimulation to deliver. The scientist Fernandez says, we customize the stimulation for each volunteer. So it's, you know, it's not just a plug and play thing. This is really hyper customized.
Well, this story is about a gentleman called Brian Bussard, who's had 25 tiny chips, you know, placed in his brain to kind of help with this vision. You know, they were installed in February 2022 as part of a study testing wireless devices designed to produce rudimentary vision in blind people. Buzzard is the first participant, 56. He lost his left eye at 17 after a retina detached, and then the right eye followed in 2016. So it's again, what just gets you, this isn't going to stop now. You know, this is not the end of the story. This is like the very first opening sentence. It's just going to keep on, Brian, like getting better and better. And, you know, in this article, he says, you know, when he lost his sight, it was just the most horrific thing ever. I can remember the day when it just went, you know. But so now he's got some sort of rudimentary vision. You know, it's like a sonar radar screen that, you know, that green on white and like blips. And, you know, when you see ships in the film movies and that. So what a just an achievement.
Progress.
From this, you know,
and how in many ways for so many people, how frightening this has to be. You know, brain surgery is, of course, it's our term for the most complex thing we could think of, and you know what it takes to say to a surgeon, a surgical team, yeah, please go ahead and, you know, meddle around in my gray matter, right? You know, stick 25 electrodes, or what's the neural link? It's kind of like an octopus, right? It's got a disc with a bunch of tendrils in it.
Is this Elon's?
Yeah. And you just think about, just on the, nothing malign, just think about the possibilities of error, you know, of small things that could go wrong. I mean, that's going to be terrifying. And of course, I can't help but think of hacking possibilities. You know, again, I go back to three-body problem, where the aliens start pressing visions on people's eyes, including a countdown and that kind of thing. But also I'd have to wonder, just kind of logistically, how do you handle this? For example, how do you handle updates? Do you have to physically go back into the brain cavity and dig it in and put a new chip in? Or do you give it some kind of wireless capacity so that you can push a firmware update into the brain matter?
There might be a USB socket.
Oh, that's James Cameron's Avatar, right? You know. Michael Crichton, actually, back in the day, I think in the 70s.
Yeah, I read all his, you know, Brian. They were me holiday reading when I was a kid as well. Do you know what I mean? They were just like.
Well, because he's such a smooth writer. But he did one called The Terminal Man, which got turned into a movie, right? Which is how you can electrically stimulate the different parts of the brain and what kind of responses follow from that. But in this case, in the story that we're talking about, it's very narrow. It's specifically geared to figuring out how to get vision back up, how to stimulate the parts of the brain that handle visual input or visual input and output. And it just seems amazing and a really powerful thing to do.
But what you said there, it must be a possibility. I know we're talking in the realms of science fiction here, but three-body problem, when they hacked into everyone's eyes, yeah. You know, and they gave that that countdown number, you know what I mean? You never know in the future if that is we've got to be careful. There's hackers out there that could kind of hack in
Imagine, certainly. There's all kinds of ways that could go. You know, you could imagine someone putting in a spam ad that won't go away, buy my shoe or, whatever it is. And it's just always going to be there. Right. If you extend this to extended reality, where someone can then get, say, direct stimulus of watching a movie this way or checking email, browsing the web, imagine some of the ways that might become a problem or not work out well. This is another story where it's just in early days.
You could, I love this way, yes, extrapolate. You could, if you haven't got the funds, you could get the trademark version where you your eyes see like the trademark symbol every day of your work at
night.
you get the cheaper version, but it's got the ads
good,
in.
Good thought, good thought. Like the one of the Kindle e-readers has that. It's got ads built in, which reminds me of, I don't know if they ever did this in Britain. There used to be American paperbacks where they would have ads stuck in the paperback book. Not for books, but for something completely unrelated, like for cigarettes or cars. Imagine that, you're walking down the street and you're looking at houses and buildings and trees and cars. And every so often something says, and remember, subscribe to Starship Sofa. How would you get used to that? Would that be a price you'd be willing to pay? That's a great thought.
I mean, almost though, that would, in a way, it would almost drive you almost insane. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? If you kept on getting like repeated ads and there's no way to,
Here's another story for you and ChatGPT to write up.
yes. I mean, that's almost, you're almost getting into the kind of Philip K. Dick realms there with that kind of idea. Yeah. You know what I mean? You're just like.
Definitely. What was the.
Imprinted on your brain.
Yeah.
We have, Brian, some more AI devices that are coming out. Now, there is a one, and it's been, again, a bit like the Humane Pin. This Rabbit R1 has been on the cusp of launch for quite a while and has been big hype up about it. But it's in the hands now of most, big influencers. They're all getting it. It's been... And it reminds me a little bit of, like 70s kind of tech mixed with the AI of today. And I'm almost reminded, Brian, like a little bit of like Fallout, this little device gadget from the TV program Fallout. But I think it's getting better reviews than the AI Humane Pin, but it's still... I've just read this article on The Verge, and again, we'll be putting links to everything. I'll describe it. It's an orange box, probably the size of half your size of a normal phone. It's a square little device. It's a luminous orange, and there's a little screen on there with an actual physical, and I like that idea, a physical scroll wheel. It almost looks cheap and plastic, but... I think it's got, and I'm not sure how much it is, Brian, to be quite honest.
$200, I think.
Right. Oh, but that's almost in the realms of, I'll give it a go. You know, when I bought that Limitless pin where you kind of clip on and it just records like your spoken voice and it can bring that back. I'm still waiting for that. I think it comes in August, but this is almost, it's from, like your, your little sneaky account where no one, you know, this is your little toy fund account where it's not hitting the house funds. I'll use me, you know, my little toy account there. $200 isn't, but I think it's called the Rabbit and the software is the R1. Have I got that the right way around?
This is the first release, the R1. And you plug into the online service that supports this, which is called Rabbit Hole, which is, you know, completely appropriate. There's this great description. The reviewer that we're reading says it's kind of like an old school MP3 player crossed with a fidget spinner.
That's a fidget spinner. He said yes. It's like the R1 is like a Picasso painting of a smartphone. That's another quote.
Well, yeah, I'm excited by that. You know, whenever you get a device that becomes dominant, you know, think about the laptop, for example, or before that, the desktop, and now the smartphone. It tends to, you know, for a while, crowd out other forms of creative design. But I'm intrigued by this, by how, you know, this is this feels like something very, very new. You know, in terms of design, you know, with a wheel built in, kind of like an MP3 player, but it's got a big enough screen, a bigger screen than an MP3 player. It has a little icon of a rabbit. The ears perk up when you speak to it, which is pretty cute.
So is this is not, Brian, if I'm right, not replacing your phone. So have you still got to carry your phone, or does this need like a data, you know, like a data package, a cell tower package, so you can.
This is entirely. It's. I think the cell connectivity is built into the, or for you Brits, the mobile connectivity is built into the service. I think kind of like it is with the, with the Amazon Kindle, I don't think this replaces the phone. I think this right now is something. It's basically a new category of stuff. It connects right now to four services: Spotify, Uber, DoorDash, and Midjourney. So one of those, Midjourney, is an AI application. Spotify, Uber, and DoorDash, I'm guessing that you would use the AI features in order to connect with those. So for DoorDash, you know, help me think of where I want to order food tonight. You know, I'm guessing with Uber, it doesn't do anything. Except just connect to it. But for right now, it doesn't seem like a replacement for your phone. Maybe in a couple of years of development and also of, you know, winning licensing agreements with all these different entities, maybe you could do a lot of phone functions. But for right now, it's a new category of thing. It's new object.
Well, it's you know, they're all seem to coming out, and then I guess, you know, the big ones, the big guns, the Apples, the Googles, are just waiting in the wings now and seeing if this category does eventually explode, you know what I mean? And they come in with, like, I think we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, it's all these devices are already here on your watch and your headphones, you know what I mean, your earpieces, so you could incorporate the software into all that anyways, you know what I mean? Just kind of, I've heard a lot of tech pundits say, everything what all these AI pins and all the human could go in a watch.
They could. Now,
we don't need this extra like category device. We just need the software into the pre-existing software. You know,
well, then you hardware. make the watch a little bit bigger, and you've got a Pip-Boy from Fallout.
Yeah.
but the other thing is, and this is, I guess this isn't something we planned on talking about. I'll just mention it really quickly. I guess we can return to it another time. But the Apple Vision Pro is a different idea. You know, having the goggles, basically, you know, a headpiece being your computing device rather than a phone or rather than a watch. And it's interesting that there are rumors that Apple has cut back the number of units it's shipping this month. So it might not have been a big success, but that was the idea, to put everything that you want into this headpiece so that, you know, you can use eye tracking, you can use your gestures, you can use voice, you can use all kinds of hand commands in order to interact with the digital world. But it was a big bet. I don't know if it's going to take off, but I don't want to get derailed in that.
No, Brian doesn't matter about running order or anything like that. What I want to ask you there then is, what is the price limit that would make you jump?
Oh,
you know, say,
oh.
Apple keep on innovating and innovating, and it changes, it changes, it gets better and better and smaller, and maybe it's glasses. What's the price point where you go, do you know what? It's work. I'm putting it down for work. That's the excuse I'm using, and I'm buying it for work, you know? So where would you come in at, you know, where would you put your hand up and say, right, I'll buy one?
I'm pretty cheap right now. So I think, I mean, looking at the rabbit's price point of 200, that's what's making me think, maybe, you know, maybe. I would rather, you know, in all seriousness, and in part because I'm cheap, I like to learn from other people to see what they've discovered. So I follow people online, and at Georgetown University, you know, where I teach, sometimes I try and see what people are doing there. Maybe $200, maybe, you know, that's, but I'm very, very cheap. I subscribe to a couple of services which send me cheap Kindle ebook sales. So, you know, I'm looking at those books for $2 or less, and that's, you know, I email people, you know, the results of that to say, yeah, I recommend these books. And that kind of...
Well, I'm on your email list.
That's what you are.
Brian,
good.
And
good.
It's actually, it's really nice, to be honest. It's like, because some ebooks is, you know, yeah, I'm not saying, but it's a, sometimes you come down to, well, which one do I get? You'd like to get all books and give authors all the, you know, the money you can, but which one do you, you know, it comes down to, can't just afford two books this month, kind of thing. So.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, libraries.
I mean, this is.
I don't know if you've seen this in the UK at all, but I mean, libraries are awesome, of course, and you know, you can check out books, but you can also check out eBooks from them. But some American libraries are doing this thing where you can check out other stuff. Our local libraries let you check out a seasonal affective disorder lamp. And you can just prop that up for winter when it gets really, really dark. Another library I've seen lets you check out a gardening startup kit. It comes, you know, a trowel, a packet of seeds, you know, a few other things, and you don't return the seeds, but you return the trowel, right? So and you can check out electronic devices from libraries, again, depending on the library and how they have it set up. For a trip, I checked out a hotspot. A mobile hotspot. I was on an American train, which are vastly inferior to your British trains, and it had terrible Wi-Fi on the train. So I checked out a mobile hotspot, and it worked great. But you know, imagine being able to check out a rabbit from a library. You know, that would make sense if they had set up right.
Well, we must have something like that, Brian. I really don't know, but I did find out. I was watching another show on the television where. And I might have mentioned it on this show as well, where if you have a library card, you can take out a digital version of the Times subscription. Do you know what I mean? Because you can go to a library and read that newspaper for free. So if you've got a library card, you can actually read, you know, them publications that are behind, you know, like a paywall in our world. You can use your library card and get that reading on your Kindle or whatever device
That's a fine thing. And it depends. Mm-hmm. It depends on the licenses. The publishers are very nervous about this. They're very careful about it. But I read a couple of journals that I access. The British Times Higher Education Supplement, the American Wall Street Journal. I don't pay for these. I get these through my Georgetown University Library subscription. So I go through the website and pull those up, and that's great. More of this, more power to them.
How does that work then, Brian? Does that just work off a web-based screen? So you've got to sit at your actual computer. You can't put it on your Kindle and walk around.
Yeah, not that I found out how. But I have to go to the website, go to the library website, search for the term, find it, and it gives me different options. Pick the one for subscription. Bang, it puts me in there. Sometimes the results are not identical to the visual output, but they have the content. So the Wall Street Journal one I mentioned before, for example, it's pretty much just a text interface, no images. And I don't mind. I mean, that's fine. I don't read that for the art. You know, I read it for the words, and that's pretty useful.
So could you, Brian, scrape that text, put it in an AI voice generator, and have it read to you?
I did it right now. Yes. Just hypothetically, yeah. And then save that as a MP3 and then push that out to my phone. Yeah, I could do this.
It's a possibility. Brian, have you got $10,000 spare? Because listen, you could buy a flame-throwing robot dog. And you know, the funny thing is, Brian, this is from Ars Technica. Some people will just buy that. You know, there's some people that have got silly money just lying around, and you can end up buying yourself the Terminator, the first flame-throwing wielding robot dog. It's completely legal in 48 U.S. states, only in America. Honestly, I know I'm kind of, do you know what I mean?
I could see
We wouldn't let this
pass. I could see Australia doing it.
Yes.
These are the extreme countries, right? You know, we're kind of lunatics. And I have to confess, when I read about this, I thought, how much could I DIY this, right? You know, but to have a robot dog with a flamethrower on its back, I love how the company lists all these very sober applications, you know.
Wildlife control and prevention.
Like, no, you're just gonna have some lunatic with too much money. You're just gonna, you know, have this running around and walk it down the street, right? Just to terrify people. You know, here's my robot dog. Watch out for the Flammenwerfer on top of it. You know, what a great thing. And you know,
agricultural management.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, ecological conservation.
It has a laser sight.
Snow and ice That's removal. Right. It's well, not going to be useful.
That would be useful. I mean, I used to live in a place with serious winter, and you get to this point where you've had snow for months, and the snow builds up, and it's too cold for it to melt, and more snow falls on top of it, and when you dig it out, when you plow it out, you run into this problem. Well, actually, where do you put the snow? And the city of Boston had this tool, I can't remember what it was called, but it was basically a dumpster, a gigantic metal box, and it had electrodes in the side, and you would just pour the snow into it, and electrodes would kick on, and it would melt it, right? So you could do that. But I've had, you know, when you have, say, 2 meters of snow, having a robot with a flamethrower does sound kind of satisfying. But did you see one of the photos? The thing comes with a laser sight as well. This is some Black Mirror stuff.
Well, I'm looking at, I mean, if you're watching our show, we're on YouTube as well, so I've got some pictures up there now. Brian, that flame, it shoots out. Do you know what I mean? That looks like it's going like 30, 40 foot. It's certainly not like a little dribble of flame. It's awesome, to be honest.
It's not messing around. It's not messing around.
And again, I'm not saying, you know, money's no object, but that price point could get some people interested. Oh, yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like some YouTube influencers who've got, got big shows who are kind of making that per video. Why don't we try that? Why we'll get that? We'll get one of them.
Well, let's get a bunch of friends together and each toss in, you know, some money, right? Just and share it around. I've got to think, you know, I use the German word Flammenwerfer, although I probably mispronounced it, but you know, I've got to imagine that this is, you know, the flamethrower was invented for World War I as a weapon of war. And imagine, you know, having a battalion of these advancing across a battlefield. Now, I mean, one of the reasons, there are two reasons people don't use flamethrowers in war very often. I mean, one of them is they're terrifying. They seem inhumane. But the other is that the flamethrower wielder becomes an immediate target for enemy snipers and everybody else. It's a terrible job to carry that around. But if it's a robot, and if the robot, if you get the price lower, you know, say down to $1,000 each, I could easily imagine some army buying a whole swarm of these and using them to clear out the opposition. And it may be an army that doesn't have, you know, a lot of compunctions about cruelty. So thinking about Syria's government right now, which already used chemical weapons on its population, or think about North Korea, you know, this, or anyone who's in a position of desperation. I mean, think if the Ukrainian army crumbles before a Russian offensive this summer, I mean, something like this might be very, very tempting to use. And of course, outside of the military use, you think about the criminal use. you know,
crowd control.
Yeah, I surrender. Take me to jail right away. You know, yeah, I'm not going to mess with a flamethrower wielding robot dog, right?
But what I tell you, what gets me though, Brian, is it's use of 48 states in America has let this. Do you know what I mean? It's like you can buy this off the shelf anywhere by the sound of it. You know what I mean? But nice to know which other states that went. You have got to be kidding. You know what I mean? There's no way. Our lot would just buy everything, so we're not going to let it go. You know what I mean? We're going to stop.
I love some of the regulations mentioned here, which I hadn't heard of, which is in Maryland, you actually need a federal firearms license to own one of these. So there's that. And in California, and this is a really California law, the range of flamethrowers cannot exceed 10 feet. So you can have the flamethrower, but it's only a short range thing.
Well, this must be taken. This picture and the video must be taken in another state because that flame there is just a weird. Do you know what I mean? It's an Ohio based. The company's called Throw Flame.
Hey, that's a pretty straight up. So, you know, that doesn't
the name. Yes, the name depicts the product.
It does what it says in the tin, right?
9,420 US dollars. Bang. I love one of them, please.
Ask Santa Claus to bring that in.
Fab. So the next one, Brian, let me just put this back. The next one we have, and actually, again, that this is something, you know, for the good of mankind, deciphered Herculean papyrus reveals precise burial place of Plato. That's just immense. Do you know what I mean? To find that kind of great guy and just know exactly where he's buried, just from what they're saying is a bionic eye to examine charred scrolls.
When people in academia tell me that they hate technology or they don't see positive uses, this is one of the kinds of positive uses I always point to. The problem is you've got texts that are unbearably fragile, you know, that are hundreds or thousands of years old, as in this case, and the material wasn't designed to last thousands of years. So just touching it can degrade it. So how do you actually get to work with it? How do you actually get to try and get out the information that's there? And if I really recommend readers and viewers to go through this article, because they're like with archaeology, there are layers and layers of technology here. Microcomputed tomography, for example, which came from the healthcare sector. You know, there are virtual flattening, virtual turning pages technology. You use all kinds of software to generate projections of what the most likely word was supposed to be. You have infrared, you have X-ray technology. I mean, thermal imaging, digital optical microscopy. I mean, it's astonishing how much technology is available in this. Some British libraries have done great work on this. Some in Italy as well. I mean, it's just one of the problems of studying the ancient world is most of the texts have not survived because they're so fragile and the various incidents of history. But you know, those that have survived can be so delicate. And sometimes mm-hmm. things have been done on them. They've been used as palimpsests. People have written on top of them. So I think this is just fantastic to be able to.
Well, the article you linked to, Brian, as well, is a lovely picture of this scroll. It honestly looks, Brian, so femma that a door draft shutting would just blow that all away.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So to be able to. To get, because it doesn't look like there's any words on this. It just looks like black flakes put together in this. It's ripped and it's torn and it just looks so fragile. But to get a detailed description or a detailed area where he's buried is, you know, Plato's buried, it's just remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. I mean, it just looks like if you sneezed, it would just... Whoosh, away, gone, lost it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Thousands of years of history and knowledge lost. But it's actually showing you, again, if you come onto the, you know, if you go for the YouTube channel, you'll see the images. Mm. You can actually see that the writing, you know what I mean? And it's there. It's, you know, there's a black and white image of like actual writing on this papyrus paper or, you know, parchment. Wow.
Yeah, and
there's over 1,000 words. Apparently they found over 1,000 words from this infrared X-ray scanners.
I mean, think about what we can recover. You know, finding the burial place at Plato, we had a guess before, but now, you know, imagine getting directions for this. Think about what else we could dig up. I mean, how many treasures of the ancient world?
I wonder, that's what I was thinking though, Brian. Do we have the right to dig up that grave, you know, for history, or do we leave it? I mean, I think this is an Italian company that has transcribed this scroll. So I wonder whoever would be in charge, do they have the right to go and, you know, dig up the
question. It's a good question. We had a similar debate in Hawaii over the sighting of a new telescope on a location that was sacred in Hawaiian religion. You know, we have now also in the U.S., there's been a movement to return Native American relics, including human remains, to the descendants and the present nations of those people. And it's, you know, it's a there are a lot of ethical issues here. You know, do you, you know, some people make the case that the academics, the scientists, the governments would do a better job of preserving these and rendering access to them over time. And then others would say, well, this is simply a question of property and identity, and it doesn't belong to you. You know, and you can't go for it. You're not a, you know, Indiana Jones kind of character. You know, you're, you know, this is something which belonged to a person. I just want to point out one thing also about this that makes this even more almost cartoonishly absurd about how difficult this is. These texts went through a volcano eruption. So here, this is the 79, the year 79 CE eruption of Mount Vesuvius. Several other cities in the area, including Herculaneum, were fried by clouds of hot gas called pyroclastic pulses and flows. But some remains of Roman wealth remain. One palatial residence in Herculaneum, believed to have once belonged to a man named Piso, contained hundreds of priceless written scrolls made from papyrus singed into carbon by volcanic gas. Then the scrolls stayed buried under volcanic mud until they were excavated in the 1700s. So, you know, they're there for 1,700 years, you know, fried in the shape.
I wonder if the process of, you know, like the volcanic, everything, you know, the eruption and everything, the gas has preserved, you know, has changed the structure and preserved them. And then, like, obviously, they've been buried. Where if they were just left on a, you know, just left to the wilds on the table and then just thrown in, you know, and eventually buried on, you know, buried and buried, we might not have gotten these scrolls. But, you know, again, it's technology put to good use, and that's just a lovely.
Yeah. I remember it was, I think, a Greg Bear story that just blew me away. It may be Greg Benford, like a lot of people I was confused the two. And the idea was someone found an ancient Greek pot and they put it on a turntable and they tried to extract the sounds that have been encoded in the making of the pot. They're basically playing it back. And I just loved that idea. You know, getting, and we've never done that, but, you know, but I just love this idea of using the technology to just exfiltrate these glimpses of the ancient past. What a great thing.
Well, didn't we talk last week about, which, and you brought up that kind of extrapolation of like, what would happen if we could go back and listen to our own language, you know, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, you know, where you're actually living now, you know, the technology could, how our ancestors talked, you know, and the words they use, which were obviously going to be totally different. I thought that just got the hairs on the back of my neck, Brian, just like, oh.
Did you see Peter Jackson's World War One documentary?
I don't think so.
I strongly recommend it because it's an amazing, it's called They Shall Not Grow Old, which is a line from the World War One poem.
Right.
And what he does is, I mean, the first thing, it's a visual, sorry, it's a movie, right, is he goes through all these films from the period and does a few different processes to basically make them not stutter.
Oh, I think I've seen when it came out, but I haven't watched the film. Oh, I know.
And,
yes.
And then he went to absurd lengths when he colorized. Now, I'm against colorization, but what they did was they did things like they figured out, okay, where was this filmed? Yeah, like, where in Flanders? What time of year? So they went to Flanders in that, you know, September or whatever, found the precise color of grass, and then colorized it accordingly. But for the sound thing, what they did was, these are all silent films because this is before audio was added, is they hired forensic lip readers, you know, who work for the, you know, Metropolitan Police and that kind of thing, and hired them to lip read the voices on the films. And then they found the people, they found where in Britain they came from, and then got actors from those locations to read that back. So someone from, you know, Liverpool versus someone from Swansea versus someone from London. And it's astonishing. I can't recommend it enough. It's just an eerie thing. There's this great moment where it's like in Wizard of Oz, where it goes from black and white to color. There's a similar moment where they show you one of these jittery handheld cameras, and then it smooths out and the color seeps into it. And you feel like you've just tumbled down a time shaft into 1917. You stop thinking. I'm looking at an artifact. You think, I've peered into a window and seen this. And then hearing the voices.
Oh, it's that good.
It's uncanny. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Oh. Well, listen, Brian, we've still got one more to chat about. And this is... But I think we might keep this for our private little talk as well, because I've just noticed there we've talked 1 hour, 15 minutes of joyful fun there. I've had this recorded going there. So why don't you, everyone, pop over to the, you know, there's a link in the description. We've got our little Patreon page where we do, you know, you can get the ad free this show as well. So there's no adverts in it or anything like that. And you'll get a little private little chat, 10, 15 minutes, me and Brian talk about something else. And this one is a nice one. Look, this one's. I'll read the title. Brian found this one. Catholic group defrocks AI priest. That's all I'm saying. We're keeping that one for the private show. But it's just lovely. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed it. Do leave a 5-star review. That would be fantastic. Do tell the folks about it. And again, if you want to join one Patreon as well to listen and support the show, that would be amazing. Brian, thank you so much for rocking up again. It's a blast talking. It's absolutely a blast. It just makes me dear. Thank you so much.
This is a treat.
Take care, everyone. Toodle-pip.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.